What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye! Welcome to Meep Meep, the Roadrunner podcast, where we go through the albums of Roadrunner Records with the artists who made them and the musicians they influenced. Let's roll! Meep Meep. What up, meepsters? I'm Ryan Rainbro, and welcome to Meepisode 51 of the Meep Meep podcast, which, as you know, is the only podcast about the albums of Roadrunner Records. Roadrunner Records. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's the only podcast about albums. Music albums, photo albums, albums, which sounds like a lawyer's name, but is also how some people mispronounce albums. And on this episode, we are celebrating the 20th anniversary of my favorite band, named after a pun based on a very time-specific storm phenomenon, Il Niño, and their RR debut, Revolution, Revolution, released September 18th, 2001. And to help us do that is an all-star cast. We have Laz Piña, a current member of Il Niño, who was also there all the way back 20 years ago when this record dropped. He'll tell us about what it was like being in Il Niño during their explosion. We also will hear from Mike Gitter, who signed the band to Roadrunner Records. He'll discuss their work ethic and creativity that drew him in. But first, an absolute legend and one of the greatest hardcore metal vocalists of all time, period. Jorge Rosado, known mainly for his work with Pioneer's Marauder, Jorge was also the original vocalist for El Niño, as well as a top contender for joining Sepultura. Two fascinating stories I'd never heard but always wondered about, so enjoy this legitimate treat of hearing the god as he delivers, over-delivers with sincerity and passion. I was the master killer. Now I just get iller. I guess it's like a 3 or 4 year period in your life where you go from leaving Marauder to trying out for Sepultura to ending up in El Niño, or El Niño at the time, and then leaving.
Okay, oh shit, that was, yeah, those are my downfall years, man. That's where a lot of my my issues and problems came from. My depression came from.
So what causes you to leave Marauder in like 96, 97?
My drummer was a weird dude, man. And he had issues. And there were things that went on tour. And there were a lot of jokes being thrown around. We joked around. And, you know, they weren't my jokes. You know, I was always hearing these jokes. And they had something going on. I mean, you got to remember, I joined the band. They wrote the Master Killer record. I joined the band when they already wrote Master Killer. And they wrote Master... Actually, the two records were kind of written already when I joined the band. But, you know, I joined the band. I learned the records, the songs, and got the deal. And we toured and everything. And there was some issues going on with my drummer. He was the only dude that I knew that walked around with kind of like a fanny pack type of thing. Because he always had like a book bag with him, like a messenger type of bag. And always had shit in there that he wouldn't let none of us get near. He played drums. He put it right behind his drum seat. You know, he put it right next to him where we couldn't get to it. He'd sleep with it. If we slept at someone's house, he had to sleep on the floor. He put it between him and the wall. So, you know, I mean, I'm always like, what the fuck is he hiding in there? Anyway, he was always a big fan of going to Holland because Holland had a weird culture for porn. And let's just say one day I walk into the tour bus. We had a one floor nightliner. And in the front, you know, you walk in, it was like, you know, the driver's area. And then we had two tables on both sides with four seats, you know, seats facing each other. Then we had bunks on both sides. And then in the back, there was like a lounge, a sofa, a little curved sofa with a little TV back there where you can lounge too. So I walk into the tour bus. I see all my band members in the back. Well, I don't remember. I think most everybody was there, some other people. And I see my drummer sitting down facing the TV. I can't see the TV because I'm walking towards them. They're looking, you know. And I see, as I'm getting closer, I see everyone's face. Like, they all had, like, a weird face. They were all, like a what-the-fuck face, you know. So I'm like, hey, what the fuck's going on? And I see my drummer just sitting there laughing, smirking. And this motherfucker would watch it. And then one day on tour, and which I found this to be weird, and I just was confused about it, we see my drummer, we're walking around, we just played our first show, one of our first shows with this band called the Birds of Uncles from Germany. Now, we're playing arenas. Our first tour in Europe, our smallest show was 4,000 people. It was 4,000 people and up. These guys were like a big rock and roll band from Germany. They only sang in Germany, and they had a problem with opening acts because every opening act they ever had gets booed off stage. We're the first band that ever won that crowd over. We played one of the shows, and we were walking around, me and my band members, and we see my drummer holding hands what looked like to be a little boy. That's how young this girl was. First of all, I would have been in New York. This nigga would have got shot, stabbed, or beaten the fuck up. You know? It just eating at me. And I just couldn't do it no more. And then with the band members, the drugs, you know, with other guys, my other guitar player just having issues with drugs and becoming a weird dude. And we rehearsed with him the night before a show. He's ready to go. We go pick him up at the day of the show. He's like, I'm not going. He's bugging out. He got some drug issues. And we ended up doing a 4-piece instead of a 5-piece. I had to get away. So when he left the band and Pokey was playing, I jumped right back in. And I went, I started El Nino with Dave Shavari, which was weird because right before that, I got called to do the Sepultura thing.
So they contacted you?
Well, it was weird how that happened, man, because I was going to places and like two or three different incidents that I had that I was in a club or walking by somebody or something that I knew and they're like, yo, what's up? They would scream out something about Sepultura to me. I'm like, the fuck are they talking about? You know, you gonna drop Sepultura? You singing Sepultura? Yo, you gonna be singing Sepultura? I'm like, what? You know, like in a club, I'm like, did this motherfucker just say I was singing for Sepultura? So people were spreading rumors about me trying out, and I didn't even know Max left the band. So I did the El Nino thing with Shavari, but I tried out for the Sepultura thing. And rumors got around. It got back to them. Some kids, apparently from what I heard, that people in Brazil were coming up to him like, yo, that dude Marauder singing. Like, I mean, people were really spreading rumors. We didn't even have fucking Facebook or none of that shit back then, you know? So I'm like, yo, what the fuck is this about? So my A&R guy, Borvoy from Century Media, contacted me, put me on a 3-way phone with Andreas. Now, I have a really big story, and I have to go really way before Marauder, during my skinhead days when I was just a skinhead going to shows. I knew of Sepultura when they were just like South America. And they were like really, really underground in New York. Nobody really knew who they were. And I was a big fan of them. And I knew this girl, and I was actually, but she worked for some little metal thing. She called me one day on the phone. She's like, yo, who I have in my house right now who just came off a plane. I'm like, who? She goes, Sepultura. I'm like, you smoking crack? Like, you know, what's wrong with you? So at that time, they were starting to get like an underground following here in the States, but they didn't really blow up yet. So anyway, she called me. I met them I was the first person they technically met here. I went to the house and met them there, you know? So they invited me and they invited my boy Davey to come hang out to all the shows. And now I also did that motherfucker Max a favor. He was wasted. And I was part of at that time I was a skinhead and I was part of the Sunset Skin. And my boys were all pretty much hanging out at a metalhead show. Cause you know, back then that's what they did. They were like, we fought Nazis and every now and then they beat up metalheads that deserved it. I was never into jumping people, but it shit just happened. It was a violent scene, bro. And it was very testosterone-y and there were a lot of Nazi metalheads back in the day. So Max was drunk. I was following him around Roseland, making sure it doesn't happen to him, you know, just bodyguarding him. He didn't even know what I was taking care of him, of all people. He stumbles. And he stumbled and he fucking bumped into my guy. A long haired dude. All you saw was like 15 skinheads. It was like fucking meerkats when they see a prey coming. They all fucking all looked at him. The only thing that saved him was that I jumped in. I said, yo, he's Latino, bro. I said, yo, did y'all say he's a metalhead, but he's Latino. And we always had a soft spot for him. We were like Latino who were like Nazis towards everyone else who wasn't a Latino. But, you know, the guys, all the white dudes that grew up and with us all came from that ghetto, too, or close by or hung out in the hood, and they all understood us. They knew that wasn't, we didn't mean it like that. You know, it was always, you know what I mean? It would have been bad for them. So I jumped in like, yo, and I said, yo, he's a Sepultura. And they all knew Sepultura. I said, they're like, oh, word? Sepultura, yo, what's up? He was really shit-faced drunk. So I kind of saved him. And I'm like, I couldn't even tell him. Say, yo, bro, you know, you almost, he was too wasted. He didn't even understand. Anyway, so I got on the phone. My A&R got us, all three of us on the phone. And I was like, yo, you remember me? I'm Jorge. I'm the skinny dude that went to all the shows and that. And they're like, barely. He told me barely. And I fucking hurt. I hurt. I'm like, oh, you don't run into Puerto Ricans like me every day. White looking and shit. Looking like fucking Christopher Columbus and shit. You know? Like, but anyway, we get on the phone call and they agreed to fly me out. They gave me $250 for 10 days and I flew out to Brazil. We go over there and I meet some guys and everything and you know, it was weird, you know, they're making a lot of promises. Oh, man, where Andreas smokes a lot of weed. They made me feel comfortable saying that, you know, thinking that, okay, you smoke weed, cool. Andreas smokes weed. Like, we're cool with that, you know. But the guy, the whole time I was there, smoked one joint with me, and it was like a pin joint. Like, I'm like, yo, bro, who rolls pin joints? I haven't seen a pin joint since the 60s, man, you know. But the rehearsals are going well. They gave me their record. I wrote lyrics to the whole record in one night, bro, with a fucking Walkman with shitty batteries. And the Walkman didn't really die out, but it started playing the songs like really slow. So it kind of sounded a little sludgy, but everything was a little faster when they played it. I'm like, oh, okay, he's out of singing everything fast. So I wrote lyrics to the whole record. And then I was singing songs. And every rehearsal, they were inviting more friends over. And they're like, yo, can we record you? And they were, like, getting into it, bro. And things were looking, wow, you know? And I'm thinking, wow, man, fucking the band that I fucking loved as a kid, you know, is, you know, I'm here with these motherfuckers, you know, rocking, you know? And it looks going well. So anyway, so we have a moment where we, they're like, yo, you know, you sound just like Phil. I'm like, Phil? They're like, yeah, Phil and Sando. I'm like, bro, we really don't sound nothing like each other, bro. So I was cool about it. I said, and I wasn't heated or nothing, you know? But, you know, I don't know. I just said, you know, Phil has a really controversial background or just political belief, whatever.
Sure.
So, screaming out white power and Zeke howling and all that bullshit. So, you know, whatever. So I just said, you know, I don't sound like him, bro. We don't sound like each other. No disrespect, but we don't sound like each other. And if anybody sounds like anybody, he sounds like me, because I've been playing this style of music since I was a kid. I grew up in the scene. I'm part of the scene. You know, I didn't jump from fucking scene to scene, identity to identity, and try to find something to cash in on. So I was like, you know, he sounds like me, because, you know, the whole thing. And then I said, you know, if he ever disrespect me, I check him. I put him in his place. But later on, after all that, they told me, which is weird, because the whole physical aspect of everything was going on, like people showing up and checking me out, they're recording me, they're all into it, we're fucking really rocking out, and I wrote some songs and shit. For them to come tell me, oh, you know, we're not what you're not really what we're looking for, you know. You know, bro, I almost cried in front of him. My throat swelled up. I'm like, you know, I got that whole, and they're like, yo, you know. And I was trying to play cool, and I was like, yes. And they made me, and after that, they made me stay at some lady's house, some old lady. They used to be like that manager when they were young. She was like some old washed up metalhead chick. And I was like, damn, it's like they kicked you to the curb real quick, you know?
Do you think they were afraid of you?
I don't know, but at that moment, I didn't know. I got back home. Now, I've always been a hustler. I came home depressed because I felt that opportunities in life only come once. And I felt that I fucked that up. I put all that blame on myself. I came back and I was just a totally different dude. I was living with my girl. I fucked up. I started fucking up. I started getting depressed. I did all the coke that I had instead of selling it. I just did it. And I'm living in the neighborhood that's not my neighborhood, you know? But I'm walking around uptown Manhattan where I'm not from looking for coke and couldn't find it. End up getting crack. I'm like, fuck, I was so depressed. I didn't really give a fuck anymore. I wasn't like a dirty bum on the street. I worked and everything, but I had like a little secret identity, you know? I got to a point that I tried to tell a couple of people and ran into more disappointments. Because here I am, I told a guy who was supposedly one of my good friends and said, if anything ever happens, like, this is what we do for each other. We help each other out, you know? So he told me, yo, Jorge, if you ever fall, because I tried to get clean and I told him, I confided him. He goes, yo, if you ever fall off the wagon, my nigga, you know, call me. Call me, I'll come for you, I'll come get you, and we'll take you somewhere and we'll get you the help. And he sounded like a brother to me. So when that did happen, I called him. I'm like, yo, bro, it happened again. He was like, yo, I'm coming to get you. He never showed up. Didn't hear from him for a fucking day, 2 days, 3 days, a week, three, 4 weeks go by. He called me, yeah, I'm sorry, man, you know, somebody had a game, ticket to a Yankee game. I'm like, what? So that really started ruining my faith in brotherhood, because when you're involved in crews and clubs and in gangs and some shit like that, there's a certain type of brotherhood that we, you know what I'm saying? Like, your friends help you move furniture. Your brothers know help you move a body, you know what I'm saying? Right. So I had that bond with this dude, and he let me know that it wasn't meant shit. So all these years of backing this motherfucker, because whenever this motherfucker had beef, I had beef. And it was I didn't care if he started it, because my boy was a troublemaker. But I backed him always. And for him to come hit me up like that and treat me like that, like I'm shit, my life didn't mean nothing when you told me, like, well, we're boys, you know. And I really relied on him because he told me that. And I took him seriously, you know what I'm saying? So I really started to doubt my friends. So it just added on to my depression, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. When do you meet Dave Shavari?
Fuck, man. Wow, man. Well, I remember Dave from when he used to play in Gothic Ham. I mean, Gothic Slam. I call it Gothic Ham. He's a fat fuck. Then I lived with the motherfucker, bro. And with Mike. With Mike from the Step Kings.
Oh, wow.
A man called the Step Kings.
Yeah, they were on Roadrunner, too.
It was me, Mike, and Dave Shavari in our fucking house. I mean, we used to fuck around, bro. We used to have some fun. But going and hanging out with Dave Shavari was probably the best thing, because they were keeping me sober. So coming back from the whole separate third thing, it led me to leave my house. I had to get out of the area. I kind of broke up my girl. I didn't really break up. I just kind of left the house. And I was a little ashamed and whatever. I went to go live with Dave Shavari. We worked and we started working on the El Nino project and all this stuff. But even when I was doing that, I was okay, but I wasn't in the right. Like, I still had my baggage. I still had my depression, and I was at a certain age. And it's, you know, it's just typical hitting your 30s type shit when you start to get a little bit mental. Like, oh, you know, you're between young and getting old now, and you're like, oh, man, my life ain't together. I'm not doing what I want to be doing. And, you know, and so... Anyway, we got the El Nino shit together, and...
So, like, what's his proposal to you to even do that band? He's like you said, he was doing Gothic Slam, so he's just like, yo, I know you're not doing Marauder anymore. I think you're sick, though. I think we should start something. I got these other guys. I mean, how does that pitch even go?
Dave brought a different type of style to the table, you know? Well, not a different style, but more of a different genre. They wanted to be a little bit more, you know, radio. But in the beginning, yeah, it had elements of that. Like, I could feel it that they didn't want to do stuff like that. And I just wasn't really used to it, you know. I might have cowered away from that, you know. And what happened with El Nino was, too, man, they dissed me. When I was going, when I moved back, see what happened was I was living with Dave Shavari, and ex-girl got a hold of me. I was always avoiding her calls and stuff like that. I was too ashamed. I just wanted to get my life together. But, you know, I had a girl that was, I was living with for like 10 years, you know, and I can't just, you know, which is weird. I got up and walked away. So she's calling me, and she knows that I'm there, but I don't want to talk to her. I'm trying to avoiding the calls and all this bullshit. So, but when I came back home, I got back together with her. But I knew something was wrong. I'm trying to get off drugs. I'm trying to get off away from the depression shit. Now it's hitting me left and right. Some, you know, other shit. You know what I'm saying? So the guys in Armenia, I think, saw that I was going through the shit again and just basically cut me off. Were like doing stuff behind my back, not letting me call, not calling me and stuff like that. And one day I said, you know, let me call Mark Rizzo up. And I just called him up just to say hello. I said, yo, Mark, what's up? And Mark like stuttered on the phone. And he was like, all I said was like, what's up, Mark? How you been? He goes, oh, what are those guys are doing? I'm not involved, man. It was not my decision. And I was like, what? What are you like? He pretty much just snitched on the rest of the band. So they were basically doing the band without me, you know? And I'm sure that Chris was a big influence in that because he's such a fucking, you know, Chris was like, yo, let me fucking do it. You know, Chris. Yeah, man, I'm glad Mark Rizzo punched him in the face.
Oh, shit.
Mark Rizzo fucking punched him in the face before he quit.
Wow, that's crazy.
Soulfly. That's awesome. I want to do that, but what was I going to join? I was going to punch him in the face and join fucking Marauder. They probably make more money than us. I'm like, you know, they pretty much went on their way. And I had my own issues, my own thing to deal with, you know. And I called it. They wanted to call it El Nino, E-L. And I'm like, yo, but isn't there a storm called El Nino that's going on right now? They're like, yeah. I'm like, it's corny. I'm like, it's corny. And it's corny for a band of music. And I said, and I'm the one who changed it to Ill. It was my idea to call it El Nino. They didn't believe me. So I said, okay, we're not going to argue about this. Just ask your friends what they prefer. And they came back that night, oh, we're going to do Ill. I'm like, I told you.
Yeah, because in God Is I, you say, I was the master killer, now I just get illa. So you must have already had that in your mind.
Yeah, that was a diss to Marauder.
Right, and then you redid that song as Marauder.
I added some more lyrics in it, I redid the song.
Yeah, I mean, the Marauder version is incredible, so I'm not trying to say that they're identical or anything. But, you know, it's the same, like, kind of first several lines, and then then it becomes its own thing.
Yeah, it's the same. I had that, because that was one of the songs that we worked on towards the end. And, we fuck around a lot. We dick around a lot. We lose a lot of studio time, and we always getting yelled at it for it. So, you know, there was a couple of songs that I was like, fuck, man, I'm going to have to, I don't really have time to write lyrics for this motherfucker. I got some shit that'll fit it. And I just put that one right into it and tweaked a few lyrics around. It was one of those rush jobs, but it was meant to be type of jam, you know, because I really like that song. I think that record was one of our most metal records ever, you know.
Oh, yeah, with all that double bass and just pummeling rhythms. Yeah, it's so sick.
Well, that's Bobby Blood on drums too, man, you know. And Chris does, like, you know, these guys do, like, 5-6 fucking vocal tracks, man. You can hear it. I'm not into that, man. I like to do 2. I don't know. He's just a dick, man. Chris just wants a lot of everything. And, you know, he just... So, I mean, I'm sure he orchestrated that whole shit with me, but that's how I pretty much went, you know. I mean, I left Marauder because of Vinny and this issues and people falling apart with the fucking drugs and El Nino fucking Separatore thing and the El Nino thing. So that was all, you know, within those, you know, I guess those 3 or 4 years I was dealing with all that bullshit. So it took a while for me to get off fucking and drugs. And it wasn't like I was really did them. You know, I would do one here, one there, and I'm like still falling off the wagon.
Well, then, you know, like 20 years later, you do the live stream with a bunch of El Nino members. It seems like there was like 12 people on that stage when you were doing it. But
yeah, I was That was amazing. That was actually, I really needed that, man. I needed that, man. I need to see them again. I'm not a selfish person. I don't know what is it with people, man. It's like they got something and they just can't run with that. Be thankful you got that. I know a lot of my homies who are not even here. You know, I seen them die in that team. You know, so I'm obligated. I always felt like if I could get anywhere in the world, if I did anything, I always felt like I was doing it for me. I was doing it for all my friends who didn't make it in life. I was doing it for people, for these kids in my neighborhood. You know, here's an option, my dude. Look, I didn't die like everyone else, man. I invested into something else that got me out of the, you know, and got me to see the world. And I didn't do it entirely correct, but, you know,
Well, what's so one really positive or cool thing you remember about being in El Nino?
When I was in El Nino, we did have a lot of fun and we did have a band. So this is why I took it. When they did that to me, I took it to the heart, because if it was just some other band, I was just, but it was, we got along, even with Chris, with those issues with Chris, you know, but I mean, everybody else, I got along great, you know, we always had a great time, man. With all that, all the stuff, you know, whatever they did and how it went down, I don't really give a fuck. But I'm glad they did it, man, because it happened for a reason. I buried the hash shit in my head, in my heart, with all that shit long ago. You know, we were young. It is what it is, man. But at the end of the day, you know, I came up with a lot of people, man. And some of those people who never did me wrong, fucking are not here, because they fucking, ultimately they did that one fucking thing that's there's no fixing that, you know? Other people did little small dumb shit, you know, I mean, it's a touchy issue. You got somebody on drugs, you don't know what, they didn't know what to expect of me, so I'm never really going to hold that against them, you know? And I'm a lot stronger than what they thought, because I did it with no consulting, no one ever consulted, no one sat and talked to me, no one fucking, no counseling, no fucking rehab, no, none of that. None of that. I thought, you know, I always said, I got myself here, I get myself out. And that's how I did it. I did it cold turkey. Man. I can't say, I lost my band, I lost my career, I lost the girl I was with, I lost my other band members with me. And I, you know, and with all that, things work out in the end, man. And they worked out for me in the end, though. And I'm here, and I am where I am now because of me, not nobody else. I don't owe nobody nothing.
That guy rocks, man. Mad respect to Jorge for sharing those deeply personal stories and reflections. This also kind of sets the table, right? You're starting to see where El Nino really comes from. They've got true credibility from the very beginning. Mike Gitter is someone else who goes way back as well. We're hearing from him as Roadrunner A&R guy, but before that he spent years traveling this actual globe as a punk and metal journalist for any magazine worth its ink at the time. He created XXX Fanzine, and he did a stint at Atlantic before working for the Big Bird. He currently is signing all your favorite bands to Century Media, but took a minute to look back on this landmark in his career with El Nino's debut and his friendship with band leader Dave Chivari.
Okay, so yeah, Dave and I probably ran in some of the same circles. You know, he was in Gothic Slam, which is a band that I actually really appreciate now. Well, I think I gave a bad review to when I wrote for Kerrang. He was in Lost Rocket before that, and he was sort of a fixture of, like, you know, the New Jersey, New York, you know, metal scene. And you know, I kind of caught wind, and I think this is, you know, I had been working for Atlantic for a while. I had started at Roadrunner, and I kind of caught wind of, like, Dave doing kind of a Latin metal take on New York hardcore. And the singer was Jorge from Marauder, who is, you know, one of the sickest vocalists out there. And I forget exactly the first time I saw them. It may, Derek from Demolition Hammer may have been playing with them at that point. Danny Gomez from Gothic Slam may have been playing with them at that point. You know, it developed very organically. But I remember there was one show, and I forget the name of the venue. It was downstairs. It was off Bleecker Street. And Rizzo had probably started just playing guitar. And I was super impressed because it was, you know, Marauder could have never topped Master Killer because there is none iller. But, you know, this was like a next growth for Jorge. And, you know, super impressive. I thought the songs were cool. I thought the Latin textures were cool. You know, Mark Rizzo is a fabulously like gifted guitar player. And, you know, Davey knows slouch on drums himself. So I saw that and I was pretty impressed. And then I saw them play, check this stack lineup, them, I believe Bloodlet, Hatebreed, and Entombed at Conallen High. And we're talking like, you know, mid 90s Entombed, when it was basically most of the lineup, with the exception of Nick Anderson. Anyway, stacked lineup. And Chris Machado was the bass player, and Rizzo was on guitar. And it was like the next step from the show I had seen before. Super impressive. It sort of just stuck in my mind. Like, keep watching this band. And from that point, you know, Dave, I think Dave being one of the best, you know, he's one of the best band leaders I've ever seen. And kicked ass, because what he did was, so he grabs, you know, Jardel, who looks amazing, is a completely great guitar player, gets Roger Vasquez to play percussion, Roger being like a star in his own right. You know, he's got Rizzo. Chris has moved over to vocals. And, Laz, who was a regular at the famous New York club, The Limelight, with his band, Broomhilda, you know, was on bass. So it's this kind of super, super lineup of, like, you know, excellent, talented homies. And before that, they had released a song on WSOU in Jersey, you know, and it really showed SOU's powers as a, you know, station in that market. You know, the song itself was inescapable. I forget what song it was. It might have been Roomba with Chris singing. And the song kicked ass. And again, you know, the Latin quotient, you know, he basically upped the Latin volume and upped the guitars. And, you know, it was sounding like this really interesting combination of, you know, obviously there was a big Soulfly influence. And, you know, because Dave had been in Soulfly, you know, Dave had done a tour with them. And I think, you know, that was a huge influence on him when he got off that tour and came back to Jersey. I think he wanted to, you know, take that concept or take that vibe or take that Latin feeling and up the ante with it, which he did in, you know, Il Nino, changing the L to the O. They booked a show at the Birch Hill in New Jersey, this club, the Birch Hill, which is sort of like a famous, you know, was a sort of a famous like 90s metal stop. You know, it was the band's first show. And there were 300 or 400 kids there. And they knew those songs. And I think El Nino may have played like 5 or 6 songs, including a cover of Soulfly's Eye for an Eye. But I came away from that show going, whoa, this band sounds completely unique, completely dynamic. The front man is compelling. He looks great. You know, he's got a cool, distinctive voice. You know, the guitar players were great. You know, like I said, Dave ain't no slouch himself. And there was just this cool energy, you know, cool unbeatable energy.
At what point did Dave come down to your office and force you to listen to the new El Nino demo to try to get you to get a little bit more interest in it than you already had?
Well, after he forgave me my Gothic Slam review, I think it was literally like after they delivered the demo to SOU. And, you know, he knew I really liked what I saw in El Nino. And he brought that demo to me, and it was just like, whoa. This is special. And it was the show, I think it was their second show, which was like a snow jam or snow core or something snow affiliated. You know, they were playing, it was literally like a small festival with Kitty, Snapcase, Sick of It All. You know, that show, it all clicked. And they, you know, for their second show, they look like a band that had been, you know, touring nonstop. They had, you know, they had the image, they had the sound, they had the iconography, you know, and there weren't many bands that really had, you know, like explored, you know, some of those Latin ideas. You know, I think you got that, you know, initially on Sepultura's Roots. That continued into Soulfly. You had, you know, Puya.
Puya coming to ya. That was the lyric. It's the Puya Puya coming to ya to ya. This is the Puya
coming straight to ya. I felt like El Nino was the band that put it all together in a way that was, you know, really unique. The songs were cool. You know, the vibe was cool. And they were, you know, I mean, and it's funny, like even at a very early stage in their career, they became sort of like a scene leader in that like New Jersey, you know, hard rock metal, new metal scene that was emerging at that point.
Yeah, you mentioned Birch Hill. You know, when I think of El Nino and I think of this time frame, I think of that venue and I think of like 40 Below Summer around the
same. 40 Below Summer, yeah.
And then there was a band called Disney Fist that they would always play with.
Oh, dang. I forgot Disney Fist.
Did you ever have any of those bands on your radar as far as being a signing?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I certainly had them all on my radar because they were in my backyard. There was some talk with 40 Below Summer. I think that, you know, they actually got handed like a pretty substantial major label deal. I was definitely interested because I still find Max to be incredibly compelling and just a complete character. But yeah, I mean, that was like a fertile little time, you know, in that Jersey scene. I mean, you know, you had those guys, there was Boiler Room.
Agents of Man.
What was that? Oh, Don't Sleep on Agents of Man. Yeah. Steve Kings. You know, on the hardcore side, I mean, it's really funny. Like, if you look at what was coming out of New Jersey at that point, it was a pretty impressive and pretty like you know fertile scene. Because in addition to all of the stuff that was going on, like in the sphere we're talking about, you also had you know Dillinger Escape Plan and Thursday, and God Forbid, Nora. Some little band called My Chemical Romance from Newark, you know, and so, I mean, that state was kind of popping at that era. And I think a lot of that had to do with WSOU, you know, being a driver, being a means of exposing all those bands really, you know, to the local area.
So after seeing El Nino with a couple shows, you see that they're looking like a seasoned band, most likely because of their experienced members coming together to form this kind of a super group of sorts of the local scene. You end up getting to sign them. I know you guys do the demo deal first and then you do the full blown record. What's the process of actually getting them signed to the label? You know, what do you have to go through as an A&R person to make that happen?
So we did the initial demo deal with Steve Evans. You know, we recorded the three songs, you know, Unreal, Predisposed, Nothing's Clear. You know, basically I played it for Monty who was the head of the A&R department at that point. He heard it. He got it. You know, he understood Dave's hustle and drive. He also saw how the band was, you know, unique to itself, and also how it fit into the culture of Roadrunner, home to, you know, Max and Sepultura. You know, maybe in his mind, I think, you know, he probably saw it as a logical next step. So from there, you know, and I think this is one of the things that made Roadrunner great, is in our A&R meetings, Case pushed us. You know, he really pushed us to make great decisions, make, you know, put our asses on the line, and, you know, really, really, really push for great, you know, great music, innovative bands, fantastic records, you know, and those meetings could be, you know, either like completely awesome or, you know, just like soul rending. But it was always done. I mean, Case was just a great coach. Yeah, I mean, like I learned a lot about how to do A&R from him. You know, I played the songs. I gave the spiel, presented the facts, and that went past muster.
Ron St. Germain initially enters the project as a producer. Can you tell me how that collaboration started?
Sure. I mean, this is after we had done the demo that basically got them signed with Steve Evitz, who had been in MOD with Dave, you know, for like a brief moment. And I thought Unreal was like a big next step for them, just in terms of you know, melody and hookiness and all that. And, you know, that was essentially what got them signed, you know. And in talking about like what records people that we all, you know, loved, the big one was the Bad Brains. Plus, you know, Ron had done Living Color stuff. And if you go back through Ron's history, you know, he's done, you know, stuff with Hendrix. You know, he's one of those guys whose career has spanned the years. And he's got an incredible amount of credits to show for it. Ron to me is one of the great old school producers. And I mean that in the most complimentary of ways. He's a producer that can get in a room with a band. And when I say a band, I mean a seasoned band that knows how to play together and knows what their identity is. You know, is he a great rock producer and engineer? Absolutely. You know, was he the right guy to produce El Nino at that point in their career? Yes and no. I think some, you know, some really good stuff came out of those recording sessions. And I think he had a lot to do with, like, you know, a lot of the energy that came off that record, you know, some of the rawness and some of the realness that came off that record and some of the great performances. I think when it came, you know, time for the mix, Dave and he had very different, you know, had very different visions on what the record was going to sound like. It would probably been more like a Jay Baumgartner-ish mix in Dave's mind. And, you know, Jay, who had done, you know, Papa Roach and POD, and, you know, is a great mixer to this day. And I think that Ron saw it as much more organic. So, you know, I think that's where they started butting heads. I mean, no great records happen without a little bit of bloodshed.
You mentioned, you know, it's exciting that Ron St. Germain is going to be on a album that you're A&Ring. I'd like to talk a little bit about your A&R style, so to speak, when it comes to the record actually being made.
Yeah, I was pretty involved in that record for better or worse. You know, like as the years have gone by, you sort of gain the great thing about doing A&R and having worked on a lot of records is no two records are alike, you know, because they're all sort of like this macro, you know, microcosm or macrocosm, whatever, of, you know, ambition, ego, artistry, and just, you know, the best of them have really distinct personalities. So that said, no, you know, I approach records I work on, you know, very differently. There's, you know, There's some bands that I've been very involved with and still am very involved with. There's some bands, like when you work on an Opeth or a Melvins record, just get the fuck out of the way. You know, let the big boys do their thing and you get to look smart. And you know, El Nino was, you know, I was, you know, I legitimately become friends with the guys in the band. You know, I was extremely involved in that record. I was probably at the studio at least once a week.
So Ron St. Germain eventually exits the project. His name is not on the album, you know, despite the fact that he produces it. So how much of the album is finished before you end up taking the recording so far to Scrap 60, which is a production team to kind of salvage, for lack of a better word, what was done so far?
I would say probably, you know, 88.3%.
That's the percentage maybe, I was going to guess. Yeah.
Maybe even 90. Like it was pretty far along. There were some ideas. Like it was pretty far along. I had known the Scrap 60 guys because they had already worked with a band on Roadrunner called Dry Kill Logic, who were initially known as Hinge. And, you know, they had done a great job on that record. And, you know, I had worked with Rob Caggiano in Boiler Room, and his partner Eddie Wall, you know, I found to be like this extremely talented, to this day, you know, producer and songwriter. So I think, you know, they were able to sort of put a mixed sensibility on it that was, I think, closer to what Dave had in mind.
Now, you mentioned, of course, the Bad Brains, Jimi Hendrix. These are legendary artists, of course. But when I think of Ron St. Germain, I think of the albums he did with 311.
Of course you do.
So I'm picturing, based on those things, kind of what you're talking about, this more organic feel. And also you're talking about how he works with these bands that are seasoned musicians. So that all makes sense to me. But I know that you're saying that the Scrap 60 mixes are closer to what you think Dave had in mind. But what do you think about the mix of the record?
I was happy with it then. I think that was an evolving process for the band. I think it came more into focus sonically. You know, that record is raw, and it is absolutely what it should be. So yeah, from you know, God Save Us into If You Still Hate Me, into Unreal. You know, there's. It has a distinct sound. It has it actually has, you know, Ron's very organic approach. And I think that shines through. I think the band's sound or sonic, you know, sonic template grew over the next few records. I think Confession was a product of the band's success on Revolution. I think that, you know, the success of the song What Comes Around, you know, pushed them to probably write more commercially on that record. And, you know, the tracks on that record that were produced by Bob Marlette really succeed in that way. I mean, it obviously became the band's biggest record. You know, it's funny. It's like, as maligned as nu metal was, and you know, people have said El Nino definitely epitomized that, you know, be it via image, be it by some elements of their music. They did it with such heart and earnesty. And I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, this is a band from the East Coast. This is a band from New York. This is a band with its roots in, you know, I mean, you had people, you know, Dave was in Lost Rocket. You know, Mark Rizzo came out of local death metal bands. You know, Jorge, well, you know, Marauder's discography speaks for itself. And even if you, you know, even talking to Chris back then, you know, his some of his biggest influences were bands, you know, were bands like Quicksand or Far. You know, and you could hear that. You can definitely hear that in songs like Predisposed.
Yeah, I think that might be one of the reasons why an album like Revolution Revolution does stand the test of time for me, is because it's genuine in its approach, right? They weren't being a gimmick. They weren't latching on to nu metal because it was blowing up. That was what they wanted to make. That was a natural progression from their origins. Mm-hmm. And I think that that shines through 20 years later. So you mentioned earlier a song like Unreal kind of immediately catches your attention. You know, you notice that that's a big symbol of growth for the band as far as songwriting and things like that. And of course, Unreal ends up being a single for the album, and it's kind of got a different aesthetic to it when it comes out for the video and for radio. It's a little bit cleaner. There's some extra piano added onto it. The vocals are a little bit raised up, but also less distorted. Guitars are down. So what is that process like, and what is that thought process like when you're taking a song from that album version and kind of trying to clean it up for radio to get more attention to that record?
Yeah, I mean the initial version of Unreal, the version that was on the album fit the album. You know, radio demanded something a little bit smoother, a little bit more commercial. Exactly what you just said. You know, just sort of fitting it into the into the climate of the day. You know, one thing now thinking about that song is, you know, how personal some of the lyrics were for Chris. And I think that, you know, that became, I mean, if it was resonant before on the album version, it definitely came to the fore on the radio version.
So we're exactly 20 years removed from the release of Revolution Revolution, September 18th, 2001, to be exact. Any specific memories of the actual release of the album that you have, especially around this time in the world, September 2001?
Well, let's go back a week.
Oh, did something happen?
Yeah, something happened to happen in New York. I was meeting Dave at the office because he was in the office actually doing interviews. And, you know, a few miles downtown from us, probably the most inconceivable, you know, tear open the fabric of like of our, you know, collective consciousness. Event happens, and not only was it, you know, horrific to, you know, be witness to that, as I was living in New Jersey at that point, getting off of Manhattan was incredibly challenging. And, you know, so Dave, one of the roadies, myself, my girlfriend at the time, all sort of made a trek across Manhattan, you know, to the west side to grab a ferry to get to Hoboken. And the thing that I think struck us all that day was how quiet things were, and, you know, how one of the you know, predominant things we were hearing were the sound of fighter jets. And it was really a, you know, inconceivable and like, just, you know, something you would have never counted on. And you know, thankfully Laz was actually in Hoboken, picked us up, and, you know, because people were literally, like, you know, walking out of Manhattan, like walking from Hoboken to their homes, you know, because I think the trains were down. So Laz got us home that day.
Laz, save us. Okay, so now we know how the band started with Jorge Rosado for Marauder. Moving ahead a little, we find out how they got signed to Roadrunner and kind of recalibrate for this next evolution or revolution in their sound. So let's find out about making the album. And who better to tell us than bassist Laz Pina? He was there in one way or another from the beginning, and he's still here today. So while the Revolution continues, we'll hear how the Revolution was broadcast. What can you tell me about that cover with that skeleton chilling on the side of the...
There was this guy, last name Peru, ironically. I can't remember his first name. Who that was actually... We were giving inspirations. It was crazy. I mean, even the things that we did as a band, we tried to do everything as a band because at the time we were a band. And so we even went to the New York Public Library together to look for inspiration that were pertaining towards, you know, our indigenous cultures, you know, of Latin America. And so we collected a bunch of images and they gave it to this artist. He came back with the sculpture, you know, the El Nino, and it became kind of an iconic thing about it. And that's how it was created. It was an inspiration of a series of artifacts. But I don't know what actually inspired him, but I do know that we gave artwork from, you know, being at the New York Public Library, and that was the result of it. And we were thrilled. We were like blown away by it. You know, it's an actual sculptor, you know, sculpture.
Okay. It's not like a digital image or anything. It's something.
No, it's made out of clay and carved out and then photographed.
And it is the El Nino. It is the sick boy.
It is the sick boy.
Very cool.
Yeah. And Jorge being the street New Yorkie slang, you know, ill is a slang. New York slang. Oh, that shit's ill. Oh, that track is ill. El Nino. The name of the band actually came from Billy Milano, as you know, because of the nature of having Latinos in the all Latino, to give the name. And I remember he called me to relay the message to Dave from Europe. He was on a SOD reunion tour. We had become friends. He lived in my studio. All kinds of weird stories. You know, who was also kept telling Dave, you gotta have Laz in your band. What the fuck are you waiting for? But he was the one that triggered the name El Nino, that later on became El Nino.
Oh, that's a cool little piece of trivia. Billy, the stormtrooper of death himself.
That's right.
Stomping in. Letting you know. Yeah. Jorge said he's the one that prompted the name change. Is that true?
That is true. He changed it to El Nino and never got to enjoy it. Was not in the band during the time of El Nino. And it kind of, and which just sucks because, you know, it symbolizes the change. But, you know, Jorge was my, you know, he was our boy for a lot of us, you know. Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, he didn't know the other guys, you know, and he came to know them in the band. Yeah, I know he likes Danny Gomez. So, you know, and we released it as El Nino, the El Nino song, only with, not with Jorge singing, though.
Right, right. When are you actually brought into the fold in any capacity with El Nino?
It was right after Jorge split and the lineup was going to be moved around a little bit. And all of this was being recorded at my studio at the time. I just started a studio. And during that time, I was also working like got bands like Madball and Agnostic Front. It was, you know, just kind of crazy. And Dave and I have been buddies, you know, for a long time. We used to, you know, I used to play in a band called Brumhilde, which he produced. But we've been friends, and we met while I was in high school, and he was in Gothic Slam, and I was in my brother's band called Brumhilde, and the friendship that began fucking over 30 years ago. So he was recording in my studio, you know, one of his projects, which was El Nino, which was also in between whether he was going to join Soulfly or not during that time period. And I actually tried to talk him into joining Soulfly, but he didn't listen. Decided to focus on this new band that he was putting together. And it started with, like, you know, I was doing like a more like Dirty Santana style bass playing. And it started with, you know, can you throw down a bass line on this section here? While recording to the, you know, the demos that were leading up to a deal. And then it started with, you know, I need you for a show, you know, until we get someone in. And just everything just began to happen so fast. And, you know, just like that, I was in the band. The band was signed after three shows, since I was in the band anyway.
Do you play on the self-titled EP on CIA?
I do.
So that had just come out, and then you guys like immediately got signed to Roadrunner?
Yeah, well, we had finished that, and Mike Gitter was really into that recording, and we signed to Roadrunner, and they allowed us to, you know, we told them that, you know, we had this already promised to the fans and all that, so they allowed us to put it out, and we did like a whole in-store. This is pre-Roadrunner.
You mentioned Jorge had recently exited. I think I mentioned to you before, you know, I had heard that Eddie Leeway at one point was going to be the vocalist for El Nino, but that was before Jorge?
That was when it was just a, like Dave was talking about it. That was, you know, during the time when he was like, you know, considering singers to go after. And it was between Jorge and Eddie. You know, he started leaning more towards something more cultural and you know, went after Jorge. They had, you know, they had known each other and became friends touring together when Dave was in Propane and Jorge was in Marauder, you know, which, you know, fast forward now, but I, you know, I produced two tracks, which I'm going to put out with some music videos of Marauder, some two bangers. I also been friends with Jorge for many years, you know, part of, you know, that Limelight, New York City scene clique.
Yeah, so, I mean, going from that sound with Jorge and even those songs and even the EP and then into the kind of more accessible and clean sound of Revolución, did El Nino already kind of have like a fan base that was rooted in the hardcore scene with how many connections you guys kind of had to that already? And was it jarring for them with this new kind of direction?
Well, you know, remember, it started out more of a like a hardcore, Latino hardcore band. With, you know, New York style, of course. So the roots of El Nino was always, you know, rooted in hardcore and, of course, in metal. So, you know, Dave was also a metal drummer, thrash metal, you know, in the early days leading up to, you know, everything else he's done. I mean, listen, you know, the band, you know, when the band was together in this lineup, you know, when Jardel, I came in with Jardel, Roger Vasquez, who was also a buddy of mine, from a band called Bay of Pigs. We played together in New York at CB's and Reconstruction. So, you know, there was, you know, a lot of connect, you know, the separations were very, very close. You know, I can tell you this, you know, there was an excitement. There was definitely something in the air that felt kind of special. You know, it almost felt like something was happening. Like we were about, like things were about to change and everything was happening really quickly. You know, we did the couple of shows, the Snow Core show at WS for WSOU, which WSOU really played a big role in El Nino, you know, attracting a deal and fan base, you know, where they were spinning all these songs all at the same time, where, you know, that was like, you know, that the magic was the seeds of magic were already sowing. And even then, just getting to that point felt special. But anyway, the excitement leading up to this thing, we got signed at Snowcore. Mike Gitter came to the show, and I've known Gitter. He didn't like my old band, so it was, you know, when he came up to me and told me that, you know, he really enjoyed the band, that, you know, he thought it was great, and he took this, you know, and I looked at him, right? Yeah, and he looked at me back. He said, "Wait a second, I know you," you know, and I think I said to him, "Man, I've been waiting a few years to hear that from you." He signed the band, and next thing, you know, everyone's quitting their jobs. You know, we got a really good advance, and it was like we were deciding on, you know, producers and Ron St. Germain, which I was probably the biggest fan of in the band. You know, felt very lucky that he was the guy. He was the producer of the record, but took his name off it later on when we went to Scrap 60, kind of to throw some more energy or heavy it up. You know, we felt like there was something that was still missing on the record, and Ron St. Germain didn't like it too much, but it was the fact that we mixed down in digital. Oh, and that was what drew him off the top. He came to the studio with a bat, and he wanted to literally fight Mike Gitter. Cops would have to be called. I mean, you know, it was bizarre.
There was also conflict between Ron and Dave, right? Over certain decisions?
Well, there was conflicts, but they weren't like personal conflicts. You know, like there was still love for Ron St. Germain, and we had a wonderful time doing the record with him, which, I mean, it was a lot of pressure. That record, actually, it was just insane, man. And we were at a, you know, the studio was owned by the guy who also owned a go-go bar right next door. And you go through one of the isolation booths, and there's another door that leads you right into this strip club. And at the time, you know, I guess we were also spending time at the strip club going in and out. It was crazy. It was surreal. Life was so surreal. And there was a lot of pressure, and, you know, and Gator would come down and they want to hear stuff. I don't know. It was a first for a lot of people to do something that big, with the exception of Dave, who had done it with other bands and his own band. So, you know, for us, I mean, I knew the reality of it. I never thought it would. I was just happy to get a record. Right. You know, so I was just trying to enjoy everything, every moment. And I was just happy to be a part of it. You know, and I couldn't believe that, you know, I played with my brothers my entire life. And this was the only other band I've ever played with that wasn't with my brothers. So, you know, doing that first record and that whole experience was, you know, pretty out there. Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, a lot of changes. Then going into Scrap 60, which was, you know, it was definitely the best thing we could have done at the time. And definitely no regrets. And that really launched, you know, a marriage with Eddie Wall, pretty much, with the band, who has been in and around just about every single record we've done in some form or another, including today, to this day. You know, we were going for singles. You know, I never understood prior to that how you were customizing songs to be singles. And, you know, it's kind of funny. It took a little bit of the, you know, of that joy of imagining that, you know, these perfect songs are written. But these songs are really, truly, you know, have to be worked out in the studio. But what comes around was decided that it was going to be an early single, but we didn't want to drop a song that had that much commercial appeal first. And, you know, and remember, we wanted to come out heavy. And God Save Us was the first single that led us into What Comes Around.
Right. Oh, man, God Save Us is such a intense song. You know, it starts off the record, because that's how, I guess, you probably want to kick things off. And super heavy. But I remember when I first heard, and I loved God Save Us, but when I first heard What Comes Around, I was like, this is something, you know, kind of special. This is a seamless collection of sounds that I hadn't heard before. And I think that, you know, you guys must have known that. You just wanted to kind of delay. I understand not wanting to come off as like a pop band, but.
Yeah, I still recall, you know, like, to me, playing in El Nino at the time felt like I was playing in a band that I've never heard before. You know, everything felt so unique to me. Everything felt so different than anything I ever done in the past or even heard. You know, and I remember feeling, you know, man, you know, I really truly did love the songs, you know. I don't wish anything, as I love the way everything turned out, you know. I participated on more writing on the next record, you know, because just the way the things, it was just so intense on the way things were coming along. But, you know, all my signature stuff, I made sure I, you know, came across on those records anyway, which kind of like stamp out, you know, kind of like the natural progression of where my bass style, you know, began to, you know, appear, and even, you know, and parts of on songwriting as well.
You mentioned being, you know, there's a lot of pressure involved. So what kind of you know, notes or feedback are you getting from the label, or I guess Mike Gitter, at the time when you're making the album? Is he hearing songs like Unreal and stuff like that and being like, hey, we got to cut this screaming out, we got to put some piano in? Like, what's the feedback on that end?
Yeah, I think that, you know, well, the reason, I mean, they hired Ron St. Germain was to make a lot of that, those moves. But Ron St. Germain really found that, you know, thought there was something, you know, more special about the band, and he really wanted to capture us more raw, you know, and more, I guess, a little bit more raw and dirty. You know, after we did the singles, he wanted like the rest of the songs to be what they were, you know, because they were pretty awesome songs, you know. But yeah, remember, there's a lot of money being spent, you know, and you know, you're taking up time in the studio and the clock is ticking. You don't have all day. And you also remember that on that first record, a lot of that writing, you know, happened in the studio also as we were making the record. I can share with you probably the most special moment of making that record was the very last song, With You. That song was written in the studio, and I think that song sums up that entire, what that emotional roller coaster of what it felt like to make that record. And when we were done, you know, it was very somber and it was just a weird experience. But it was definitely the most magical moment, you know. And those, you know, playing that, you know, we were sitting, jammed those in this side room there. It was like a little living room area. That's where we would sit there to rehearse and go over parts. And that song came out of a jam. It wasn't being written for the record, but it was, you know, so strong that, you know, Ron St. Germain said, let's get it in the studio right now and let's record it. And that's how it came out. It's great. Best, you know, probably my favorite song in there.
Yeah, normally I don't like when albums end with like the slow, soft song, but there's something about it coming off after the title track, which is just, you know, a Mack truck, like the hardest song on the whole record.
Yeah.
Those cool rolling R's that get me stoked every time. And then you have this kind of release With You that is like a beautiful song. I mean, it's gorgeous. So I actually really love that song. And normally that wouldn't be my style. I'd be like, why are you ending with this soft thing? We should have left me with the punch in the face. But I actually love that song a lot.
It's like we just went and did this intense, you know, I shouldn't say yoga, but intense exercise. And then we, you know, we capped it off with some real relaxation, like yoga, you know, but it was intense. Maybe hot yoga.
Some Bikram, yeah. Well, it's almost like the epilogue of a movie, you know, Revolution is like.
But, you know, at the same time, let me tell you something. You know, we all different come from different backgrounds. So we did want to make catchy songs, though, you know, as well. You know, that we just didn't realize on how, you know, how much you had to alter songs to make them suitable for radio. And that was a big lesson, you know, for us. So, you know, we learned also how to even write that style. So by the time the next record were, and all the others, you know, the writing style had already progressed. And with each and every record, you learn a little more. And there was always a natural progression to all our records. And we did a lot of experimentations. And we managed to stick around all this time, which is a freaking miracle.
Right.
I was, you know, I was happy at the first one. And, you know, I told Dave, you know, as I remember, Dave said, you know, this is like the real shit. You know, you can't punk out. You got to go through it. And, you know, and I gave my word, and I didn't realize it was, if I had known that it was going to last 20 years, I don't know if I would have, maybe I would have, but that's a big commitment, you know.
Now, you guys re-recorded some of the songs in Spanish. Was there ever consideration to just put a full Spanish language song on the record?
We did, but a singer at the time didn't want to just sing a whole album in Spanish. And so it was just, he didn't see a point in it. I don't know. It was just at that, you know, we were lucky to get the Spanish songs we got. You know, it was always, you know, a thing, you know, translating some of those words was most of the time, you know, they were written mostly all in English, and we'd go in there to create translation sometimes. It was funny.
Because the one thing about this album that I've always thought, this isn't even just like reflecting, is that like the lyrics are kind of, I don't want to say bad, but like they're very simple, you know, that like, I mean, he says some kind of like corny cliche things, but when it's in Spanish, you don't hear it sounds sick. So I always loved the Spanish versions more because I didn't have to hear some of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, the Spanish version, like the most of that type of slang though, is the way we were naturally even speaking to each other. Mm. So it was, you know, at the time, you know, the slang at the time. So to us, you know, it was, you know, those were like no brainers, you know, we'd used all the shit that, you know, we were always a kind of band that always cut up on each other. Mm-hmm. You know, some were better at it. I was, you know, I try to just stay away from it because I wasn't that good at it. Dave was the king of it, you know, and everyone always had to try to get their shot at him.
I Am Loco. How did I Am Loco happen? You know, it's kind of like a beat, like a programmed beat almost more than like riffs. Yes.
That song was Omar Clavijo is a 19-year-old kid at the time who was creating beats, who was friends of Chris. And he had this one beat that was just, you know, killer. And, you know, they played it to us. He played it for us at the studio down in the basement when I had my studio there. And Mark Rizzo just played along with it. And that song was written instantly.
That's such a like standout on the album because it's so different from everything else on there. I just was always curious. And I know Omar is a big part of a couple records that you guys do, right?
Yeah, Omar was also doing the scratches and some of the samples on the records. You know, a lot of that stuff with Dave was doing it with, you know, with this old school sampler that he had. But when we started getting a little bit more fancy, that was like Omar's specialty thing. So when we did Confessions, Omar was like full on. We even brought him on tour. I mean, the first record took us, we toured for 2 years straight on that Revolution record. Never imagined that we'd do so much touring. I remember feeling so homesick and, you know, missing out on family events and, you know, things that matter. But, you know, when you're out there doing this, you sacrifice a lot of things. A lot of people don't understand sometimes the sacrifice, you know, so it's like, I have a child now and just thinking about going on tour, getting that separation anxiety definitely fucks with my head.
My favorite moment of seeing you guys tour this record was the Primitive tour. It was El Nino, Shovel, Insolence, and Soulfly. And you guys opened the show and you played Eye for an Eye by Soulfly. And then later that night, Soulfly played Eye for an Eye by Soulfly.
We played it at the same show?
Yeah.
I don't know what possessed us to do something like that. Are you sure we played at the same show?
Yeah, I'll never forget it. It's something that I remember forever.
Wow, I remember that. That was our, you know, that was the very first El Nino tour. I remember that show, and I remember this cat that I met who later on, because there were some people that I met that I stayed in touch with. This guy, Tom, Big Tom, who moved around the South. I used to see him again, you know, throughout the years. But there was another cat there who passed away that was at this show as well, like about a year later. Yeah, I remember that show. I remember it vividly. And that's, you know, so many shows ago.
Yeah.
But the first tour, you know, you remember a lot.
Even to this day, you end sets with the song Liar. What is it about that song that you guys are drawn to so much?
It's just a killer song. It's a killer song. It ends well with a bang. You know, it's that kind of song that makes people want to jump, and it just brings, you know, just closes the show with a really nice, strong energy, and, you know, people give it all they got, including us. I mean, during that song, I give it all I got. As I know it's the last song, and so, yeah, we haven't played it with the new lineup yet, and so I'm looking forward to bringing it back into the set list soon.
Rizzo, of course, is the guitar player on this album, and he's known for just guitar virtuoso, but not a whole lot of shredding on this. Was that tampered down by the label or Ron St. Germain or anybody, or that was just not his style yet?
No, well, it was his style, but it wasn't the band's style. It wasn't something that we were aspiring to do. We were trying, but Rizzo did these layering, like he didn't need to shred. His rhythm was impeccable, and his layering, the things that he layered these songs on top and underneath the choruses, that's where, you know, a lot of that magic that Rizzo has is, you know, when you think of Rizzo, you think of shredding, but you don't think of the layering stuff that he's a master at, you know, of making just, you know, vocals pop out and, you know, really to reach. I mean, he's a talented all around player, songwriter, arranger, and soloist. Incredible player.
That makes sense that it just wouldn't fit. Yeah. I mean, when you listen to these songs, you don't. It would almost be jarring if there was just like a solo across it sometimes, right?
I mean, we did like acoustic solos on the following record. I mean, and, you know, a lot of people don't realize that Mark Rizzo played on that record, on Confessions, which came out later on. You know, he had split, you know, before the record was made, but he did finish the recording. And he got to shine a little bit more, and we had a little bit more standout licks, and you know, he really killed it. And the flamenco style guitar playing that he also brought to the band was a very, very big part of the band. So, you know, very important member. I really enjoy Mark Rizzo also as a person. He was a young kid then. He, you know, I'm 10 years older than him. So at that time, it's a big difference, you know. Just a great all-around person. So, you know, him and I'm very happy to have recently reconnected and reignited that friendship as if, you know, never missed a beat.
And those jump kicks in that backpack, that was a big thing of the El Nino image.
Oh, let me tell you something. That backpack is coming back on Rizzo as well.
Okay.
That backpack is coming back, man. It's going to come back, and it's going to come back on a new level. I think it's going to light up and all kinds of things.
He traded it in for cargo shorts recently. I saw they were stocked too. They were packed up.
Yeah, no, he's going to be doing some cool reinvention soon. And people are going to be like, whoa, where's this guy coming from? But he's got a lot of cool things up his sleeve. I know this.
All right.
Yeah.
What is something that you would have done differently on Revolution, Revolucion?
You know what? You know, like recently when we did that live stream recording, we did a lot of those songs, and I got to replay them live the way I would have played them on the record today, you know, because I play them differently now. So I kind of felt like I got my redemption. And we're going to put that out at some point, that live recording. And just, you know, you didn't have time to do anything else but to focus, you know, if you wanted to be heard on that record. Everyone was focused. Everyone was, you know, looking to contribute and put their best foot forward and be heard. And, you know, and that goes for the percussionists, you know, and Roger Vasquez, who was just terrific on that first record. And Danny Cotto, who came in on the second. My cousin played congas on the Confession record later on. You know, and the work that some of these people, you know, do, I mean, it's just equally important. The samples, you know, the producers, the mixers of what your sound, how it's going to be heard when it's all pieced together. So, you know, Ron St. Germain, who's not credited on that first record, you know, it wouldn't sound the same if we hadn't, you know, began and pretty much, you know, completed all the tracking of that record, you know, with him. You know, so many people were a part of the history of this record, and the fact that it's still around and we're still talking about it is a great privilege. So, yeah, it took a team, and it was a revolutionary record to make for its time. And I'm glad that it survived the test of time and we still hear it and play those songs today. We've gone through so many different parts of our lives throughout these years and all the different rendition of the band and, you know, the rock and roll cliches, you know, and also, you know, the wonderful moments of coming back also with, new music like the way we are now, where there's a lot of excitement, and it felt like a revolution. And that's the feeling Dave and I have been currently enjoying, that we keep reflecting to this landmark period that's been out, you know, going to be 20 years, where we feel like it's revolution all over again, where there's that excitement, where you feel special things are occurring, and there's an energy and electric in the air. I feel very, very fortunate that, you know, that's the band has progressed, and we've managed to still stick around and, you know, put out some kick-ass tunes.
So there it is, the complete revolution, the total rotation, 20 years of an album that is both a snapshot of my youth and a mainstay of my truth. Il Niño came from their humble hardcore beginning to the plan, and decades later, we're still talking about them, thanks to their hard work and dedication and great songs. Thanks to Jorge, Mike, and Laz for their time, knowledge, and stories. And check out Il Niño's new music, including the single Mascara, which should probably be a luchador entrance theme. Look out for new music from Marauder, and please come back and see me next time for an all-new episode, an all-new Meepisode. Hey, maybe you'll hear how that Sepultura story ends. Anyway, while we wait, I'm still Ryan Rainbro, this is Meep Meep, and yes, that's the best that I could come up with. Bye!